If somebody without a lot of education or specialized training suffered an illness that left them with a violent tremor, an enlarged heart, and difficulty speaking, you don't need to be an employment expert to know they might have a hard time finding work. But when a man in Tennessee applied for Social Security disability benefits for exactly that reason, he was told to not give up his search. He could find a gig as a nut sorter or a dowel inspector or an egg processor. Except those jobs don't really exist anymore. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Workers at the Social Security Administration and judges who weigh in when applicants appeal are working off a long list of jobs and their qualifications called the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. It lists more than 12,000 different positions. But it hasn't had so much as an update since 1977, the era of typewriters and rotary phones. So while many jobs once done by humans are now handled by robots and computers, people with significant disabilities can find it really hard to get help getting by. Journalist Lisa Ryan covers federal agencies and the management of government in the Biden administration. You can find her recent reporting about Social Security disability benefits online at the Washington Post. Lisa, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start here, if you'll indulge us, with the absolute basics. What are Social Security disability benefits and who are they meant for?
This is a federal program run by the Social Security Administration, which, of course, most of us think of as purely an agency that distributes regular retirement benefits. But if you're disabled and you are primarily low income and, you know, you don't have a pension or other benefits from a private employer or, you know, somebody supporting you or family money, you would turn to the federal disability system. Which administers benefits to about 15 million Americans every year under two programs. One is an anti-poverty program for truly poor people who may not have a work history at all, as well as poor elderly people, and to others who have a work history and who are applying to essentially get their retirement benefits early without a penalty because they've become disabled. This is a big, big program that, while not as well known, you know, to those of us who are not disabled, you know, eats up a lot of the Social Security Administration's operating budget.
Are the monthly payments for people on disability comparable roughly to what retirement benefits they might receive?
Yes and no. So a lot of the criticism is that this program, which is an area that, you know, I did not write about last year, is that, you know, the benefits are pretty paltry. I mean, the anti-poverty program called Supplemental Security Income, you know, the benefits you get through that program, if you make it through the gauntlet, applying, you know, range from something like $400 to $1,000 a month, which is really not a lot. With the other program known as disability insurance, it really does depend on what you earned before, but people end up getting somewhere, I'm putting this broadly, but between, you know, $1,200, maybe $3,000 a month. It's really not a lot.
Okay, so you said gauntlet. That implies this is not easy. What is the process of applying for these benefits?
So I should say it's not easy simply because for any safety net program, you know, the government needs to make sure that it is not distributing benefits to people who should not be getting them, who are not eligible for them. And, you know, with any safety net program, there are political considerations, financial considerations, and essentially this is a very hard program to access. So you apply, and often if you have a lawyer or otherwise, you're just a representative who is representing you, helping you apply, I think your chances tend to be better because the application process for both of these programs is extremely complex. You know, you have to list your assets. If you make too much money, you're not eligible. You have to list your work history if you have a work history. And of course, you have to submit just reams and reams of medical documentation of your disability, understandably. And then employees at the Social Security Administration look through your application, and first they have to determine, well, first, whether you earn too much money. If you earn too much money, you're eliminated from consideration. Then they look at whether your medical condition has rendered you disabled. And then once they determine that, they have to determine whether you have any, residual capacity to work. And once they determine that, they have to decide whether you can do your past work. And once that is determined, if they decide you can't do your past work, then, and this was really the subject of the story we did in the end of December, the agency has to decide, if you can't do your past work, can you do new work? Can you perform a new job that may be, and in most cases, this would be a new job that would involve it would be a sedentary job involving unskilled work. And that's where the vocational parameters come into play.
Okay, so your reporting on the piece we're talking about focused on Americans who apply for disability benefits but are turned down because, according to the Social Security Administration, there are still some jobs they would seem to be able to do based on this thing called the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. I mentioned a little bit about it in the introduction, but tell us the history of this thing.
Sure. So this is a really fascinating journey into history, reading this document, which anyone can find, any of your listeners can find online. Just Google Dictionary of Occupational Titles. It's no longer a living document because the Labor Department, which first put it out in the Depression to help match American workers who were unemployed, with jobs across the country, the Labor Department retired it in 1991 because, they kept updating it, which was perfectly reasonable because they said, okay, well, between 1938 when it first came out and 1991, it was a way for the Labor Department, which puts out, myriad databases on, the nature of work, occupations, skills needed for occupations, lots of economic statistics put out by the federal government. But this one, is a database that listed the jobs in America and what was required to do them. And but in 1991, the Labor Department said, you know what? We're not going to update this anymore because this database is just, it is. It needs to go in the dustbin of history. The jobs have changed so radically that we need to put this to bed and come up with something else.
So the jobs that might be most relevant to people applying for disability benefits are the ones listed as you said, sedentary and unskilled. What are some of the positions that the list suggests? The list, which was put to bed by the Department of Labor, but is still in use by the Social Security Administration. What are some of the positions on that list that people are supposed to be able to get in 2023 instead of getting disability benefits?
That's right. So, as you said, the Social Security Administration has kept using it until today. And, we can talk about this, but they have gone through many permutations to try to update the list. But the jobs on the list, so the list started with about 13,000 jobs, but the ones that Social Security are still interested in for purposes of disability determinations are 137 jobs. They are unskilled sedentary jobs. And the reason for that is because most people applying for disability benefits fall into those categories. They don't have college educations by and large. They, need unskilled work. And if you're disabled, you're more likely to need a job that is not involving manual labor, but you're sitting down. So the jobs really have some wacky names. There's one job that we didn't mention in the story, but is a surveillance expert where, and the description of this job is that you sit, it is sedentary, you sit in some sort of a transportation facility and you look on a monitor to look at film of passengers, at the time, airline passengers or train passengers, passing through to see if anything, any of them look funny or have anything weird in their pockets. And disability advocates told me this is so crazy because after 9/11, of course, TSA came into existence, and this whole system, radically changed with up-to-date technology. So that's one of the weird jobs. I mean, another is an addresser, which is literally someone who, by hand, this is the description in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, addresses envelopes, maybe for a business in the old days, by hand. I mean, it specifically says that. And sure, someone in theory could sit and do that job. That's the whole craziness of this system.
You mentioned that you can look this up online. I did, and spent far too much time looking at some of these jobs. There was telephone quotation clerk, which is someone who's supposed to be able to answer phone calls from customers who want current stock quotations that are posted somewhere on an electronic quote board that I guess somebody saved from 1980. I am not a jobs expert, but surely the internet killed this gig in the same way the automobile gutted demand for wagon wheel builders. Does the list and its use, even today in 2023, calculate the numbers of these jobs actually available to people who might want them?
Well, that is where the plot really thickens here. And thanks to your readers for for listening to this kind of arcane conversation about government policy, but that is incredibly important to the lives of disabled people. So, since Social Security is still using this database, what it does is the agency hires about 1,500 people on contract all over the country. And these are vocational experts. And the vocational experts are mostly hired at an appeal level. So if you, let's say you are denied for benefits, which actually happens in the initial stages in two-thirds of cases, you may want to appeal to an administrative law judge who will have a hearing on your case. So at your hearing, a vocational expert comes in, and they are working for Social Security as a contractor. And their job is to look through the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. And, once you're the claimant has been determined, that in theory, they could still work even with their disability. They go through the list of jobs, and their task is to, okay, find some jobs. They have to come up with a minimum of three jobs from this dictionary that the person could do. But then the law says that they have to tell the administrative law judge, who's going to make the ultimate decision on benefits, how many jobs exist in the national economy, and I'm quoting the statute, in these occupations. And so this is a really, really controversial part of the process that honestly, the agency, when I asked them about this, really could not defend. And what many people told me is that the vocational expert just kind of does some back of the hand calculation, and sometimes they literally make it up. I mean, these cases have gone to court. Courts have really, really been brutal on the agency in showing how it's just how unfair what the vocational expert comes up with.
Lisa, I want to talk for a minute about why the Social Security Administration is still using this list that everybody agrees isn't good enough anymore. Why have they not moved on when other agencies have?
Well, that is really the million-dollar question. And when I ask Social Security to give me an answer to that question, they declined to answer my questions. Instead, they gave me a statement from the acting commissioner, Kilolo Kijakazi, that basically kind of reiterated back and said, look, this is what we have right now. And that was pretty much it. So back in 1991, when the Labor Department said that it was not going to update this list of jobs, Social Security started wringing its hands, and everyone, I mean, they're smart people at this agency, they realized that this was really not going to be a functioning system for helping determine whether someone should get disability benefits. And they spent 10 years, appointing committees, literally, to discuss this issue. And this is kind of how the federal government works in a lot of ways. Things move very slowly. They have to reach consensus. It's just a really frustrating process in the government. And, you know, the private sector moves much more quickly. After 10 years, you know, there was a discussion of, well, whether the Social Security Administration itself could come up with a modern database itself. That discussion went on for years. They decided, no, that they really needed to hire someone to come up with a modern database. They hired the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is part of the Labor Department, in 2011, 2012, I think it is. And BLS, you know, which is really the gold standard for doing any kind of statistical analysis, they started down this path that they're on right now, you know, I don't know, almost a decade later, more than a decade later, to send field economists to a sample of, they're now up to 60,000 employers, where they have asked them long and extremely complex questions about the nature of work as it relates to disabled people, you know, including the cognitive demands of work. You know, they've done enormous work to the tune of somewhere between $250 million and $300 million. But the agency has refused to implement this data that BLS has done and put on its own website for the public to look at. I don't really know if anyone in particular is looking at it. And the reasons, as it has been explained to me by current and former officials, are complicated. Sometimes it's, you know, I've been told that this is politically a very fraught issue, because there will be winners and losers once you modernize the data. Some people will, you know, end up being denied benefits. More people may, you know, be granted benefits. Part of it is that Social Security has existed for much of the last 30 years with acting commissioners, and they have an acting commissioner under President Biden right now. The president shows no sign of nominating a new commissioner. Acting commissioners tend to not really do anything drastic. And what I understand is that, you know, they keep telling the Bureau of Labor Statistics to refine the data. But when I talk to the economists at BLS, between the lines, I got the sense that the data is ready to go.
So what might be the motivation for holding off on using it? Is this about saving Social Security money?
So it's a really complex question that I think does get to the politics. So during the Trump administration, you had an administration at Social Security, and this is just a few years ago, who really, you know, brought a mindset of wanting to shrink the safety net to this agency and to the disability program. And so the Trump commissioner, Andrew Saul, who was confirmed by the Senate in a rare confirmation, because Democrats tend not to get confirmed, you know, he moved forward, actually. He and his team moved forward with a regulation that would have implemented this modern data. And that's already, you know, now four years ago. But accompanying that was basically a series of proposals where they wanted to tighten eligibility for benefits. And their belief, shared by many conservatives and many, you know, many people in America, including the new Republican House of Representatives, who, you know, as we know, is really going to be taking a look at safety net programs. And one of their agenda items is the Social Security Disability Program, and it's the very same philosophy. Their view under Trump was, look, too many people are on disability benefits. Many of these people could work. There are more college-educated people in America today, And there are more sedentary jobs because we're no longer a blue-collar economy. And people, because they're more educated when they're disabled, they can learn new skills. So that was their philosophy. But when this started to be proposed, there was huge pu pushback from Democrats, huge pushback from disability advocates. Then when Biden came in, the whole effort was quashed. And so I mentioned this history of in the recent past to explain why, according to many people I spoke to for this story, there has been no movement on this. Because the flip side, okay, so the flip side though is that disability advocates, many of them, are convinced that yes, people who maybe more educated now, but if you take people who are not educated and you offer them, sedentary jobs today, they won't qualify for them because they're so complex. Therefore, the theory goes that those people would have to get benefits because they would not be qualified to do a lot of the computer jobs today.
There's also this problem of incontrovertible evidence that even well-qualified people with disabilities often find it harder to get hired than people without disabilities. That's against the law, but we know it happens, and we know there are many accounts of people who have struggled to find employment. Does the disability system account for that in any way?
No, and that's really, from what I understand, that's just a real failing of the system. Social Security has done a bit of research in recent years on whether, the Americans with Disabilities Act and, the ways that employers really should use it to accommodate people when they work, whether the federal benefit system that we're talking about in this conversation should somehow incorporate the ADA, into its decisions to help people find work, for example. But Social Security actually has rejected, the research that sort of suggests that, hey, we should use the ADA to help employers, in helping us make these decisions. And I think their view is that it's sort of a more small C conservative view. They're there to administer a disability program, and they're not really focused so much on helping people find work. I mean, that's a complex issue, but it's not really, their mission right now. And, you mentioned how hard it is for disabled people to find work. What advocates I've spoken to told me is that, under the theory of the Trump appointees, right, which would be, hey, if we modernize our list of occupations, more people would have to get denied because, they would be able to easily do computer jobs just sitting down. Of course, advocates disagree with that. But what they said is, look, when people get denied for benefits on the theory that, oh, they can still work at whatever job, most people do not end up finding jobs. I know that there is data on this, and I can't cite specific papers, but many people have told me, look, just because you're, we're not in a manufacturing culture anymore, just because blue collar work is really not the norm in our country anymore, really does not mean that a disabled person can work all day, at a computer doing complex internet tasks.
What about this? The guy that you sort of anchor this story around, Robert Hurd, who had two strokes, used to work as an electrician, now has been denied for benefits because he could be an egg processor or a nut sorter, according to the federal government. I looked this up, and like the average wage for electricians in this country is something like $50,000 to $60,000 a year. Presumably, dowels inspectors and nut sorters are making close to the minimum wage, which in Tennessee is $7.25 an hour, or about $15,000 a year. Do the rules for denying benefits based on employability take former income potential into account?
They really don't, which is really sad. I mean, there is, you know, you can, once you get benefits, you can earn a couple of $1,000 a month, but it's pretty low. And no, they really don't. I mean, what they take into account is your prior earnings. So, you know, you can't have been making a lot of money or, you know, in your prior job before you became disabled, because you would disqualify, you would not qualify for benefits at the early stage. But once that kind of crude decision on your assets and your former income is decided, they don't, they're not really required to find you, I put in quotes, but to find you, or to recommend or to say that you could perform a job, you know, that's commensurate with what you earned before. So no, it's a really good question to ask, and no, they don't.
Another thing, reading your pieces, Lisa, that surprised me is that, you know, Social Security, like every large government bureaucracy, is not perfect, but it is a pretty modern organization in that, you know, beneficiaries in, say, the retirement system, they can get direct deposit. And even when the government shuts down, Social Security recipients continue to receive their money. I mean, they're in some ways a pretty well-oiled machine. Why has it taken, did you say $250 million worth of work to create this updated list that still isn't in place? Like, where is the disconnect there?
I know it's such a good point, because you know, tens of hundreds of millions of Americans get retirement checks every month, and also, you know, 15 million people on disability also get their disability checks. So, like much like the IRS, Social Security is one of those agencies that, despite this, you know, kind of happy rolling along with you know, the digital world, they still have a very sketchy history with big IT projects. And the IRS has had the same struggle. You know, some of the IRS's data databases are using COBOL, and Social Security is the same way. Literally, some of the disability examiners, you know, in each state who look at initial claims, I mean, until a few months ago, we're reviewing claims on COBOL. That is a 1960s software. So, yeah, and so, you know, what the agency says, and I obviously they have a point, is that in the last 25 years or so, you know, there, as the baby boom has aged and retired, you know, the number of claims that they have to process, just straight up retirement claims, has really exploded. And their budget, while it certainly has grown every year, their argument is, you know, it has not grown commensurately with the workload. Now, they have gotten more digital, but they have always struggled with big IT modernization projects. Now, in this case, you know, they had a very top-notch contractor, you know, in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And just, you know, to say a little bit about that, so BLS gets paid a little over $30 million a year by Social Security, and this, you know, it seems like a reasonable amount of money, because what BLS has said to me is that, you know, what they want is that for this new modern database, which is going to be interactive and extremely sophisticated, they would need to update it every 5 years, understandably, so that, you know, what happened with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles doesn't happen to this modern database. And so every 5 years they have to refresh the data and send their field economists out to new employers on the horizon, you know, in who are reflecting new occupations and maybe reflecting, you know, new conditions for disabled people. So, you know, the money annually itself does seem like a reasonable investment. And I think in this case, it's the agency clearly, you know, has not gotten this out. But my sense is that, unlike other straight ahead IT projects, this project has suffered from, I think, you know, a lot of internal politics, a lot of external politics, because, as we said before, it Even though it's very wonky to try to understand vocational policy, it does go to the heart of how many people are approved and denied for disability benefits. And conservatives always will try to limit eligibility because they're more suspicious of safety net programs and they want to spend less money. And we're seeing this already in the discussions on Capitol Hill right now. And liberals and Democrats tend to have an opposite view. So it's vocational policy is really has been, as long as this project has existed, fraught with really complex questions about, the nature of the safety net in America.
Lisa, what sort of toll has this taken on people working within the Social Security Administration, who, of course, are bound to follow the rules set for them, but may be working there, be motivated by a desire to help those who can no longer work? I mean, has this contributed to attrition within the agency?
Well, I don't know that the vocational policy itself has contributed to attrition, but the agency is really going through a really hard time right now in that they've lost thousands of employees, in the pandemic. There are problems, deep, deep problems with customer service as the field operations have returned. After the pandemic, there's tensions about telework and tensions with Congress, which has not really, given them budget increases that they really feel they deserve. And as we know, the labor market is really, in free fall right now, and it's very hard to, for them to hire and keep workers. But this has had a not a huge effect, not just on claimants, but yes, on you asked about employees. So where the vocational questions come into play is at two levels. It's at the hearing level where the administrative judge is considering a claimant's appeal of a denied claim. And the judges, I talked to many judges who said, this is really hard for us because we have to come into the hearing and we review the claimant's file, and we're just relying on these vocational experts to tell us what to do, and we don't always believe them, and we know that they're really struggling themselves. And I did speak to the vocational experts themselves, some of them who say, they're really not happy. Yeah, I spoke to one who actually retired early and said, I just couldn't do this anymore. I felt like I just wasn't giving accurate information. But there's another level at the initial claim level where this comes into play, and these are for disability examiners who are extremely low-paid workers in state offices in every state capital, who have to review these claims for vocational criteria that we talked about. So it's really incredible. Disability examiners, and these people are paid somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000 a year, and it's just a brutal, brutal job. So they get the claim and they have to look at someone's medical conditions. They have to, submit, they have to request more medical recs for them. Finally, they get to these vocational questions, and they too have to look at the dictionary of occupational titles, but they don't have a vocational expert helping them. And they have to make these decisions on their own. And in some states, these disability examiners don't even need college degrees. And it's really, really complicated stuff. So the vocational piece of the disability determination process is just one of many, many factors that are leading disability examiners to quit in droves. And the agency is really, really struggling with a labor exodus in that part of its organization.
And consequently, there are enormous backlogs, right? How long does it take to process an average disability claim, whether that claim is accepted or rejected?
So I did a story on this question in December. So these state offices now have a backlog of more than 1 million claims. These are initial claims and also the sort of second claims at the second level when someone has been denied and then their case is reconsidered. So the normal amount of time is somewhere around 6 to 8 months for, which is a long time when you're disabled and you really, really want benefits. That is it has really, really exceeded these numbers. You know, sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's 14, 15 months. We talked to many, many claimants all over the country for that piece that we did on the backlog, who, you know, who waited 16 months for initial determination. Then if they wanted to appeal the claim, the clock started again for them. And, you know, there are just so many stories of people who can't get through on the phone. And imagine if you don't have a representative, a lawyer who's helping you navigate this process. It's really brutal. And it's a priority for the Social Security Administration to deal with this. But one of the problems they have is just that they're relying on the states to hire disability examiners. It's a brutal job. It's a low, low, low paid job. Imagine trying to hire these low paid employees in a city like Austin, Texas, which is now this booming tech capital where very few people can afford to live. And then in many cases, you're relying on governors in, you know, conservative states who are hesitant to, you know, give these people at this pretty obscure part of the state government, you know, raises. And then if you give those employees raises, you've got to give your other, you know, it's employees in the state government raises. Social Security pays the salaries of these employees, but it's kind of this hybrid state federal operation, and it's really struggling right now.
Are the people who are eventually approved for disability benefits entitled to compensation for the time they had to wait for their claims to be processed? I mean, you and I are probably doing much better than any of the folks we're talking about, but what would we do if we couldn't work for 16 months and had no income?
Sure. So you are, if you go through the process of, and it's a really lengthy, brutal process of appeals. And you can appeal a case to federal court, you know, if you have, I mean, in most cases, it's if you have a great lawyer who wants to go that route with you, although it takes years. But yeah, there's a complex process of appeals that can take years. But if you do get benefits, yes, you do get back pay. The tricky part of this is that if you have hired a private disability lawyer, that lawyer understandably is going to get a cut of your back pay. And that's how, you know, the private disability system works. If you negotiate the system of appeals yourself, and then you would get everything you're entitled to. If you hire a legal services lawyer, you know, their salaries are paid by taxpayers. But yes, it's just an arduous process. And, you know, and as I said, it's, you know, bears repeating that at the initial claims level, 2 in 3 claims are denied. And certainly not every claim, you know, is meritorious. That's, I mean, many people try to get benefits and they just don't qualify. But others probably do qualify and, you know, are turned down, or it just takes forever for them to get through the system.
Lisa, setting aside people who might apply for disability benefits in good faith, but just not qualify, are fraudulent disability applications thought to result in a lot of undeserving people getting money from the federal government every month?
I'm so glad you asked this, because it's a controversial part of the system, but fraud exists, and it is, you know, I think in any safety net program, there really is fraud. So fraud investigations are the purview really of the Inspector General at Social Security. And that is basically, you know, the watchdog over the agency. And they have a mission as you know, happens in the government with any safety net program, to take tips. And my God, I think they get tens of thousands of tips literally a year about fraud in the disability program, believe it or not. And obviously, you know, a fraction of the tips, you know, really come to fruition. But yeah, I mean, I think that, so the way it works is that the Inspector General's office has federal agents, and they investigate fraud in many different ways. You know, sometimes there is large scale fraud, and that's the kind of fraud they want to go after, you know, in particular, where you have a doctor, you know, who is putting his or her stamp, you know, on medical records saying that someone's disabled. And, you know, doctors make a lot of money have in the past made a lot of money this way. You have lawyers who also are do this. I mean, there have been some very famous cases of this. It's called facilitator fraud, and that is something that they really have to keep special tabs on. But sometimes the fraud is a little more nuanced in that, someone receives what's called an overpayment, where let's say they're getting benefits and they pass away, and a family member doesn't report the person's death to the Social Security Administration, and the family member keeps the benefits. And this could really go on for years. And that's definitely fraud. I think it's sort of classified as what you call sort of passive fraud, because one of the things about this program that makes it, vulnerable to fraud is that it's really a self-certifying program, in that you get a notification, I think it may be every month or maybe less frequently, from the agency. You get something in the mail, in snail mail, that says you need to tell us, if you have acquired any assets in the last month or 2 months or whatever it is. If you're working, what your income is, if anything has changed, in your financial picture as well as in your medical picture. And then there's the last thing, which is something that Social Security itself does. And this is, they do continuing disability reviews. These are called, it's called program integrity, which is sort of a code for making sure that people are still medically disabled. And so the person gets a notice in the mail that says, look, we need you to go to a doctor, and have a checkup and notify us, that you, I'm kind of simplifying the process, but that you're still disabled. And the money for this kind of work has fluctuated, but that's another way that that the agency has to work, on sort of quality control, if you will.
What plans does the Senate Finance Committee have now to look into operations at the Social Security Administration? Will they be targeting exactly what you and I have been talking about?
So with the new Congress, I'm watching really closely to see what happens. So in general, what I'm really looking for with the new Congress, as well as with the Senate Finance Committee, is I'm looking for them to, I'm looking to see if they pay attention to a lot of things. One is customer service at Social Security is really, really, really struggling. People are waiting long, long periods on the phone. This is just retirees who are looking for information, as well as disabled claimants. They're waiting, long periods on the phone. They're waiting in field offices to get served. There's controversy over, how many people should be teleworking, because, the field office operation, half of those people are working from home. There's lots of questions from conservatives who have taken over power in the House on, whether they, well, at every federal agency, but in particular this one, whether so many people should be teleworking. Is that compromising customer service? So there's that piece. Then there's the backlog that we spoke about. And there is now pressure, from our reporting, on a lot of these state offices to hire, more disability examiners, and to streamline some of the processes that are pretty cumbersome that they have to go through when processing disability claims. And then there's a lot of attention now, I think, on this, the jobs piece that you and I spent, much of this hour talking about. I think it's a more complicated one, because it's hard to just say, okay, we're going to start using, the new Bureau of Labor Statistics database. We're going to start using it tomorrow, because it doesn't really happen that quickly. I think that they would have to, if they wanted to move forward on this, propose a regulation, put in the Federal Register, get comments on it. I mean, train their staff to use it. I mean, this could really take a while, but I mean, I feel that there is now some political pressure on the agency to pay attention to this, because I think it was really not on Congress's radar in any way, and I really hope that we've drawn attention to it. And lastly, I think the question that many people in this In this area of the government are wondering is, why hasn't the president nominated a permanent Social Security commissioner?
Journalist Lisa Ryan covers federal agencies and the management of government for the Washington Post, where you can find her recent reporting about Social Security, disability benefits, and other subjects. Lisa, I not only think the wonky stuff is important, I also think it's really interesting. So thanks very much for explaining it all to us.
Thank you so much.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast. It's free wherever you get podcasts. You can also check out the podcast on our website, and you can sign up there for our new e-newsletter. That's at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.